Hello and welcome to The Autograph with me, Susan Medeiros. I am joined by Christian Parenti. He is the author of Lockdown America, Soft Cage, and The Freedom. Today we will talk to him about his newly released book, Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change, and the New Geography of Violence. Stay tuned. Award-winning journalist and author Christian Parenti is a contributing editor at The Nation and a visiting scholar at the Center for Place, Culture, and Politics at the City University of New York's Grad Center. He has reported extensively from Afghanistan, Iraq, and various parts of Africa, Asia, and Latin America. His work has appeared in major publications including Fortune, The Washington Post, The New York Times, and Mother Jones, among others. He holds a PhD in sociology from the London School of Economics. His new book is titled Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change, and the New Geography of Violence. According to Parenti, from Africa to Asia and Latin America, the era of climate wars has begun. Extreme weather is breeding banditry, humanitarian crisis, and state failure. In Tropic of Chaos, the author travels along the front lines of this gathering catastrophe, the belt of economically and politically battered post-colonial nations and war zones, girding the planet's mid-latitudes. What he finds is shocking. Parenti sheds light on the unsettling presence of Western military forces and explains how they see opportunity in the crisis to prepare for open-ended global counterinsurgency. The book opens with the story of a cattle herder who has been killed in a cattle raid in Kenya. Parenti looks into the history and politics of cattle raids in the northern parts of the country, but also unveils that the dimensions of intercommunal civil war are now at play due to climate change and environmental stresses.
Ekuru Lorimon lay beneath a flat-topped acacia tree, its latticework of branches casting a soft mesh of shade upon his body. Ekuru had been a pastoralist from the Turkana tribe, who live in northwest Kenya, on the arid savannas of the Rift Valley. He had been killed the day before when a neighboring tribe, the Pokot, launched a massive cattle raid. The group of Turkana I was visiting had been pushed south by severe drought and were now grazing their herds at the edge of their traditional range, very close to their enemies, the Pokot. In the pastoralist corridor of East Africa, a pattern is clear. During times of drought, water and grazing become scarce, the herds fall ill, and many cattle die. To replenish stocks, young men raid their neighbors. Why did Ekuru Lorimon die? What forces compelled his murder? To my mind, while walking through the desert among the Turkana warriors, scanning the Karasuk Hills for the Pokot war party, it seemed clear that Ekuru's death was caused by the most colossal set of events in human history, the catastrophic convergence of poverty, violence, and climate change. This book is an attempt to understand the death of Ekuru Lorimon and so many others like him through the lens of this catastrophic convergence.
Christian Parenti, thank you so much for joining us on The Autograph.
Thank you for having me.
While we often address the issue of climate change as solely an environmental challenge, in your book we read that climate change intersects with the already existing crisis of poverty and violence. You call this the catastrophic convergence. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I mean, the argument of the book is that climate change rarely just looks like bad weather, a flood, tornadoes, hailstorms. It more often appears as ethnic violence, religious violence, migration, political and social pressures. And what I try and do in the book is unpack the connections between these pre-existing problems across the global south of inequality and poverty left by neoliberal economic restructuring and violence left by the legacy of the Cold War and its proxy fights, and how these pre-existing crises are now being exacerbated by the onset of anthropogenic climate change, which is causing intensified drought, flooding, erratic weather patterns, which is stressing agriculture and fishing. And in countries where people live closer to the land, they have less margin of error, and so we're seeing the social fallout from early climate change.
And How has the weather changed in the areas that you talk about? Because I know you start your story, you start your book with the story of a man in Kenya. Mm. Is drought our primary concern right now at this point?
I mean, in many ways, that's what one experiences most, it seems. But, for example, in Kenya, the actual pattern is that there's more precipitation. There's been an increase in precipitation over the last 20 years, but it feels like there's drought because the rain is coming all at once in sudden floods. So you get this pattern of drought punctuated by flooding. And then if there is rain, it comes frequently at the wrong time. So even if there isn't just a simple shortage of water, there's a disruption of the hydrological cycle that then leads to the economic equivalent of drought. If you don't get the rain at the right time, crops don't work. Mm-hmm. So it's a mix. You know, you saw increased rainfall in the U.S. last summer and this summer, flooding in the Midwest where corn is produced, drought in Russia and Central Asia, but also in many of these places, sudden crazy floods.
And so naturally, politics and social order go hand in hand with climate change, as you argue in your book. For example, in Afghanistan, which the war in Afghanistan, right off the bat, is not considered a climate war, but mm-hmm. you look at this war from a different perspective.
Yeah, and I don't argue that climate change caused the war in Afghanistan, but I argue that there is a climatological element within the war, and it is that Afghanistan has been suffering during this whole NATO occupation the worst drought in living memory. And the Afghan government and NATO troops attack poppy. The Taliban defends poppy, defends the rights of farmers to grow poppy. Well, why do they grow poppy? One reason is that poppy uses one-fifth the amount of water as wheat. So when the government forces are encouraging farmers to grow wheat or apricots, traditional crops, there's a climatological impediment for the farmers making these decisions because they're suffering the worst drought in living memory, and there's one crop within those conditions which is economically viable, and that's the illegal poppy crop. And there's one force in the country that's defending their right to do that, and that's the Taliban. So along with all the nationalist questions of young Pashtun farmers in the South, along with all the kind of nationalist ideology that might motivate them to support the Taliban, along with all the religious ideology that might cause them to support the Taliban, there's another very simple materialist reason, which is that these guys will defend your right to grow this illegal crop. And that's kind of one of the only ways people can survive. So it's an important contributing factor to why there are young men willing to fight, why the war drags on and on and on. The Cold War sowed instability throughout the Third World. Its myriad proxy wars left a legacy of armed groups, cheap weapons, smuggling networks, and corrupted officialdoms in developing countries. Neoliberal economic policies, by that I mean radical privatization and economic deregulation enforced by the International Monetary Fund and World Bank, have pushed many economies in the global South into permanent crises and extreme inequality. In these societies, the state has often been reduced to a hollow shell, devoid of the institutional capacity it needs to guide economic development or address social crises. I look at Latin America, where there's an earlier history of neoliberalism that begins in the 1980s. But I also look at India. Since we just talked about Afghanistan, let's go to India. In India, there is a guerrilla war. The Naxalites, a collection of Maoist parties, has been fighting a war against the Indian state since 1969. And over the last 10 years or so, while there's also been increased drought in India, particularly in eastern India, they've moved out of the areas where they began in the northeast of India and are moving down the eastern Ghats, the mountain range of the eastern India. And you can see that where drought extends, the Naxalites soon follow. And part of the explanation for that is that India began liberalizing its economy in 1991. This has been associated with increased growth rates, et cetera, et cetera, the new class of billionaires in India. But the benefits of this growth has not been equally distributed. And in the countryside, what liberalization has meant is stripping away all the old semi-socialist supports that farmers had. And so they can't rely on the government to build, drill wells for them, maintain their irrigation, help them with crop supports. So they are more often than not borrowing money on the private market, but they face this drought. So then they go into debt, and then they lose their land and are humiliated, and thousands of them have been committing suicide. But others support the Naxalites and commit political homicide. So that's an example of how you see, you know, liberalization feeding into this warfare. The history of neoliberalism is more broadly, it begins out of the crisis of the 1970s, which is, in a nutshell, the world economy goes through a long boom after World War II, and that's basically a process of rebuilding all the destruction from the war. And that allows for high rates of growth, high rates of profit, rising wages, rising taxes. By the late 60s, the world economy is sort of glutted, and growth rates and profit rates begin to stagnate. Then there are the oil shocks of 73 and 79. And for a lot of countries like Brazil and Mexico, they had been borrowing to fund their industrialization, and that had been working during the long boom. And in the 70s, that began to stall out because the world economy as a whole wasn't growing, so it was harder for them to sell things. So they borrow more and more. And in the case of Brazil, which is one of the countries I look at, which is now a major oil producer, but then it was an oil importer, major oil importer, they had to borrow lots of money. So by the early 80s, they were heavily indebted and the world economy was still quite stagnant. And in order to service their debts, they had to go to the IMF and World Bank. And the IMF and World Bank told them that they had to privatize state businesses, open their markets, deregulate all various sectors of the economy. And so again, you see this pattern where in Brazil, farmers are increasingly left to their own devices, increasingly forced to borrow on the private market and lose their land and have to migrate off the land into the cities because the state isn't there to support and kind of contain the process and help them along with whatever calamities might befall them. And so that's an economic process that has sort of shaped the environment for a lot of people around the world right now, you know, and then as climate change kicks in, it makes it all that much harder for them to cope.
Parenti writes, Western military planners, if not political leaders, recognize the dangers of climate change. Instead of worrying about conventional wars over food and water, they see an emerging geography of climatologically driven civil wars, refugee flows, pogroms, and social breakdown. In response, they envision a project of open-ended counterinsurgency on a global scale. The author looks at the reasons why the West, or the global North, prefers to address the issue through military adaptation.
And you also talk about the West, or the global North, as you put it. They prefer to invest in projects of counterinsurgency that are open-ended, according to your argument, instead of addressing the dire needs of these countries that are affected. Mm. Why is that?
Well, what I say is, I mean, it's not quite that the West as a whole. What I say that the Pentagon in the U.S. and other militaries in OECD countries, you know, rich countries, are thinking about climate change and planning. You know, these militaries generally don't make policy. The U.S. military doesn't make policy. It has to implement policy. And so the armed services are looking forward, and they see that it could create all sorts of problems, like increased migration, stress on weak states that maybe could cause weak states to become failed states. That's going to cause civil war, a civil war of an ethnic sort, of a religious sort, that kind of stuff. And so they run these scenarios, and they see a future in which they are going to be called upon to maintain and contain this process of social breakdown in the global South. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, to their credit, they almost always in these reports say, unless something is seriously done about energy policy, this is what we're going to be dealing with. So they don't predict large conventional warfare between states. What they predict is internal warfare, banditry, guerrilla warfare, and that puts counterinsurgency front and center. So I examine sort of what is the history of counterinsurgency. And I argue, I mean, not that I would expect the Pentagon to do anything different, because that's their job, is to plan for, you know, to look at what the threats of the future are and plan for it. But I don't think counterinsurgency ultimately is going to work. I don't think that the wealthy parts of the world can wall themselves off and contain a planetary decline as climate change kicks in through violence. That really what has to happen is there has to be a transformation of the energy economy in this country, in the U.S. and elsewhere, to really cut emissions so that climate change, that the worst of climate change can be averted. But, you know, we're locked in for some disruptive climate change no matter what.
And you do tell us about the various ways of addressing this phenomena, mitigation and adaptation, which the latter comes in different forms.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, mitigation in the climate discourse, mitigation means cutting emissions, essentially, you know, mitigating the problem and switching the technology from which we get energy away from fossil fuels towards renewables. And adaptation can have, adaptation means, you know, adapting to the effects of climate change. And adaptation can have a physical aspect to it, like building seawalls to cope with rising sea levels or coming up with new farming methods, but it also has to have a social aspect to it. And that's where the question of social justice comes in. That, you know, for societies to have the resilience and the capacity to deal with the kinds of disruptions that are going to come with climate change, there not only has to be a physical adaptation, but there has to be a social adaptation in which I think wealth and power are redistributed in a more fair fashion to help cut down and reduce social tensions, because inequality is definitely associated with rising social tensions, and then that in extreme situations can lead to violence, which then, you know, in the worst cases can lead to, you know, actual state collapse, and then there's no adaptation or mitigation possible at all.
And the forms of adaptation that you also talk about is the politics of the armed lifeboat, which leads to climate fascism. How is that?
I mean, what I'm arguing is that, you know, there's kind of, this book is about the possibility of more progressive adaptation, but then there's also this bad forms of adaptation of, you know, people turning to the gun to adjust to a more difficult situation. And I mean, in the opening of the book with this, you know, guy who's been killed in a cattle raid, that's an example of, you know, basically bad adaptation. These people, the state has abandoned the Turkana pastoralists in northwest Kenya. So there's no supports for them to turn to. There's a bad drought, 10-year-long drought going on, which is making it harder and harder for pastoralists to survive. So what do they do to survive? They turn to their own resources, which is AK-47s, to try and steal their neighbors' cattle to survive. So that's like a type of adaptation that leads to warfare. And what you have in that region is this you know, crisis of violence. That at one level you could say, well, that's crime, cattle raiding. But at another level, it's gotten so intense and so organized that it's almost a form of intercommunal warfare. Mm-hmm. Another form of bad violent adaptation would be what we were talking about before, counterinsurgency, just like seeing the future as inevitably one of just open-ended warfare where the wealthy economies have to kind of maintain their borders and, you know, send in troops to fight low-intensity conflicts. And I see that dependence on counterinsurgency into the future as a form of bad adaptation, militarized adaptation.
And we travel around the world with you in this book and come back here to the United States. What do we see here? We see border issues with Mexico that, you know, once again, it's very always related to the drug war and immigration and issues like that. But once again, it has to do with what's going on in the climate.
So, yeah, I mean, I try to, again, like border militarization in the U.S. is a project that's been underway since the early 1990s. And we have about 30,000 people, imprisoned immigrants who are undocumented at any one time for immigration violations, not because they've committed a crime and are wanted for theft or murder or something, but simply because they don't have their documents. So we have like a whole, you know, jail system just for immigrants. We've got this, the technology of warfare all along the border, surveillance, drones, you know, motion sensors. The U.S. military is deployed down there to train. Now, so this is not caused by climate change, but increasingly immigration and migration is being pushed by climate change, and I have some examples of that. So I try and tease out what you can imagine the future holding, and by looking at the discourse around border militarization, and there's a kind of really, you know, a racist discourse around border militarization mm-hmm. coming out of particularly like Arizona and the West. And some of those people are actually, you know, giving it an environmental spin and starting to talk about climate change. And instead of saying, hey, you know, the planet is in crisis, we all have to pull together and solve these problems, it's much more the discourse of an armed lifeboat.
And finally, what needs to be done and how do you see the future of our planet?
Well, I don't necessarily have any prediction of how I see the future, but what I see the present, I see possibilities in the present. And it's very easy for people to become disheartened and hopeless when thinking about climate change. And also in this country, the political process has become so contaminated by money from the coal and oil industry, they've really blocked any kind of new legislation around climate change. But there is a lot that can be done without any new legislation. The Environmental Protection Agency has the authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. The Obama administration has been waiting and holding back on allowing or mandating the EPA to really set its targets for regulating greenhouse gas emissions from smokestacks. They need to do that now. The EPA needs to set really robust targets to cut emissions. That doesn't need new legislation. That's something that can be done now that's not happening yet. And then there's also a lot that the U.S. government can do without appropriating new money or anything. The U.S. government, the federal government, plus state governments, is about a third of the GDP of this country. If government spending on vehicles and energy and building maintenance and construction took place according to a really robust green agenda where you sourced only from wind power, not from coal power, the government bought only electric vehicles for the post office and its, you know, general services agency as opposed to diesel and gas vehicles, that would be good in and of itself because it would reduce emissions directly, mm-hmm. but it would also indirectly help solve the problem by creating economies of scale. And so all these companies that are trying to sell wind power into the grid or trying to sell battery technology to the automakers would suddenly have lots and lots of orders, and they would then be able to make their products more efficiently and more cheaply. And when clean technology such as wind power and electric cars is cost competitive against old technology like coal-fired electricity or gas cars, only when it's as cheap or cheaper will people then just switch en masse. And so that's a really important role that the government could play. And this is, the government is going, the federal government is, has the largest fleet of buildings in the country, largest energy consumer in the country, largest vehicle fleet in the country. It's going to spend money on energy. It's mm-hmm. going to spend money on vehicles. It could spend that in a really progressive, positive way by just choosing green technology and helping to nurture those markets and the companies that, that produce those products. But again, that's something that hasn't been embraced by the Obama administration. They're, you know, they've made gestures in that direction. There was an executive order passed that this should happen, but then there's been delays and it's not been front and center. I mean, you know, fundamentally climate change has not been taken seriously by the Obama administration because they are afraid of the pushback from the right on this issue.
Christian Parenti, thank you so much for joining us on The Autograph. We hope to see you again soon.
Thank you very much for having me on.
That's all the time we have for this edition of The Autograph here on Press TV. Thank you for staying with us and watching. Remember, you can always send us your emails to theautograph@susanmadaris.com. We're always looking forward to them. Until next week and another show from all of us here in New York City. Goodbye.
New legislation. That's something that can be done now that's not happening yet. And then there's also a lot that the U.S. government can do without appropriating new money or anything. The U.S. government, the federal government, plus state governments, is about a third of the GDP of this country. if government spending on vehicles and energy and building maintenance and construction took place according to a really robust green agenda where you sourced only from wind power, not from coal power, the government bought only electric vehicles for the post office and its, you know, general services agency as opposed to diesel and gas vehicles, that would be good in and of itself because it would reduce emissions directly, mm-hmm. but it would also indirectly help solve the problem by creating economies of scale. And so all these companies that are trying to sell wind power into the grid or trying to sell battery technology to the automakers would suddenly have lots and lots of orders, and they would then be able to make their products more efficiently and more cheaply. And when clean technology such as wind power and electric cars is cost competitive against old technology like coal-fired electricity or gas cars, only when it's as cheap or cheaper will people then just switch en masse. And so that's a really important role that the government could play. And this is, the government is going, the federal government has the largest fleet of buildings in the country, largest energy consumer in the country, largest vehicle fleet in the country. It's going to spend money on energy. It's mm-hmm. going to spend money on vehicles. It could spend that in a really progressive, positive way by just choosing green technology and helping to nurture those markets and the companies that produce those products. But again, that's something that hasn't been embraced by the Obama administration. They've made gestures in that direction. There was an executive order passed that this should happen, but then there's been delays and it's not been front and center. I mean, fundamentally, climate change has not been taken seriously by the Obama administration because they are afraid of the pushback from the right on this issue.
Christian Parenti, thank you so much for joining us on The Autograph. We hope to see you again soon.
Thank you very much for having me on.
That's all the time we have for this edition of The Autograph here on Press TV. Thank you for staying with us and watching. Remember, you can always send us your emails to theautograph@susanmadaris.com. We're always looking forward to them. Until next week and another show from all of us here in New York City, goodbye.